scare me when you put us on microphones. We're betting on basketball games up here and open the Senate Revenue in the Thursday, March 10th. So here is the order. We need another member to go. My preference would be to at least begin work on 32 and 480. Looking for maybe call Senator Brzezinski and see if he's available or Senator George. And as soon as we do that, we'll get Representative McPherson up here to talk about his two amendments that he brought us this morning. If we don't have that third member here in a moment, then we're just going to do our public hearing on Senate Bill 839 and then go into work session. And the goal would be on 480, since that's the bill we've been working and working and working on, the Voluntary Compliance Initiative and the General Tax Amnesty, would be we will hear four different amendments and then recess until 10, and then we'll hear two from Representative McPherson, recess until 10 o'clock this morning when we have a full committee, and take a look at whether we're all prepared to move that bill this morning or if we want to hold off yet another day. Okay. Senator Brzezinski is on his way. So if anyone knows the Jeopardy music, we'll just hum it and wait for Senator Brzezinski. Okay, let's open work session on Senate Bill 32. And just briefly, Paul, this is a bill we're really familiar with. Let me just get that one teed up and ready to go, and then we'll jump into 480. So, Elizabeth, just remind us on 32.
Sure. Chairman Deckard and committee members, the Senate Bill 32, this is the bill that basically was the Department of Revenue's bill brought forward to really give them some rules to waive those penalties on taxpayers for good and sufficient causes that result due to an incident being the first offense for the taxpayer. So they already have in law the discretion to be able to waive penalties for taxpayers for good and sufficient cause, but this expands that definition so it is allowing those first time offenses of the taxpayer, and that was getting at Senator George's example that we had discussed before. And then in our last hearing, we also, you know, you got on record and stuff as far as the Department of Revenue having this still in place during that amnesty period. So this was,
right,
you know, the other component of that this would be, this would go in conjunction with your Senate Bill 480, so that this would be something that they could have that discretion at the same time they're having the amnesty go on.
Great. So we'll return to this because I like keeping these together, and as soon as we know if we're going to move 480 here at 10, we'll move that one with it or make a decision to hold both of them. So I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 32, open a work session on Senate Bill 480. And let's have, Paul, can you walk us through the dash twos and the dash threes?
Okay.
And then we'll have Representative Pearson walk us through the fours and the fives.
Okay, Mr. Chair, the language under the first part of the dash twos are as before, the Voluntary Compliance Initiative, and actually very similar to House Bill 2486, using much of the same language. The first major change is the on page 9, the committee discussed dates. And under Section 15, this is where the Voluntary Compliance Initiative defines the date as during the period beginning on the later of the effective date of this 2005 Act. You can't put an emergency clause on it, so it has to be 91 days at the after sine die, or November 1, 2005. So, in other words, if you're done in June, then this would become effective November 1 if you're done in September 1st, then it would become 91 days after that. And then the period ends January 31, 2006. On the next page, it wasn't clear, although I had assumed it in the revenue impact. It wasn't clear if those that had been issued a notice of deficiency would be eligible under the VCI. And Section 4 there at the bottom of page 10 makes it clear that a taxpayer may not participate in the voluntary compliance initiative if prior to November 1, 2005, the department has issued a notice of deficiency to the taxpayer. So, and the department has identified some people from the California data. They would not be eligible for the VCI. The next, about midway through page 11, you had talked about an 8-year look back on tax returns. This actually bumps it back to 10 years. So that's was an increase from 8 to 10 years, taking you back 10 years through the 2004 tax year. The other components are under the general amnesty program, starting on page 18. And those that are eligible in eligible tax years are applies to years for which the department could issue a notice of deficiency. And this means that it goes back, in terms of non-filers, back beyond 3 years. The time period for the general amnesty would be July 1, 2006 through September 30th, 2006. So that sets the time frame following the general amnesty. And recall, you had a discussion at your last meeting with the department about how they'd best be able to administer, and it was their recommendation not to run the amnesty and the VCI concurrently. And so it does not do that. At the bottom of page 19, it makes it clear that those that are eligible for to participate in the voluntary compliance initiative cannot participate in the general amnesty, and the department will send them a notice saying that they're not eligible and that they would be subject to penalty under the new abusive transaction penalties. One of the things that did affect the revenue impact estimates was on page 21, subsection D. Under the previous, the Dash 1 amendments, the installment programs could run out through 2010. So that was shortened up, and it really is based on the department's current practice of running 12 to 18 months on these installment plans. So December 31, 2007 is the date in which that that would end. So you'd have to have all the payments completed by then. And that does pull more revenue forward into the current biennium. So the other elements to it, the taxpayers who have not been issued a notice of deficiency will have their both penalties and interest waived if they come forward. Those that have received a notice of deficiency would be eligible under the Dash 2 amendments and would be, but would only have their penalties waived, not their interest. So that's the distinction between those the department has identified and issued a notice of deficiency versus those that they haven't. So the other elements of the program are the same. The last piece was on page 24. It does add some of the language that Elizabeth just talked to you about. Senate Bill 32 comes in there under Section 4 on page 24 in terms of giving the department some flexibility under different conditions. Now, the Dash 3 amendments are the same as the Dash 2s. I can't say that with all confidence because I haven't had quite a chance to go through all of it. But the key difference, though, is on page 20, Section 3, is that under the general amnesty program, a taxpayer may not participate in the tax amnesty if prior to July 1, 2006, the start of the amnesty period, the department has issued a notice of deficiency to the taxpayer or, in the case of accounts receivable, or has assessed the tax for a tax year. So what this does is eliminate from eligibility for the general amnesty those the department has, in effect, in the system. So that's the key distinction between the two. I have prepared a revenue impact estimate for you, and it looks really at both of them. If you look at the revenue impact on the front page, is all in terms of the dash 2, but if you turn it over and look at my calculations for the dash 2 amendments, and this is laid out as you saw it before, where it defines the VCI, and I have changed some of these, going back and making some further adjustments. An $11.4 million generated by the VCI. Talking with Deborah, they are estimating that the fiscal impact of this element alone of the program would be less than $50,000. So they're basically looking at, as we've talked about, a relatively small number of taxpayers. They're getting the information from out of state and are gearing up for that. One of the things that, as we talk about fiscal impacts, that we'll need to make sure we do is coordinate with the budget and ways and means process. The net revenue from unidentified taxpayers, and calculated the same way as before, where I really highly depended on the Michigan amnesty for my base data, and then assume there's certain penalties and interest that would have been collected anyway. There's higher at post-amnesty penalty. You have the 25% post-amnesty penalty. That's ongoing. So the net revenue from that group is $10.1 million. So if you add those two together, it's $21.4 million. That's the dash 3 amendments, because that would exclude that bottom group. So 21.4 for 05-07, and then 1.2 going forward due to the new abusive tax shelter penalty and the post-amnesty penalty primarily. The dash 2 amendments allow for eligibility those identified taxpayers, and you can see it's a pretty big chunk there in terms of gross revenue, $27 million. As I say, I've pulled those forward because of the shortening up of the installment plan, the payback period. And then, of course, you have penalties you would have gotten otherwise, not interest here, because you're not forgiving interest. Revenue collected under current law, we're assuming that these people are going to be paying, it's just that they're going to be paying more slowly. So the net effect is that you get from the amnesty program net, instead of 10.1, you get 11.9. So you get another 1.8 from that group. But in the out years, it's a negative, because, again, those are dollars we assume would have been collected over time. So if you look at the dash 2, it's $23.3 million in 05-07, and then minus $6.8 million in 07-09. So that's the revenue implications of your choices between the dash 2 and dash 3.
Questions for Paul on the dash 2s or the dash 3s?
Yes. Mr. Chair, we have spoke about any type of nominal penalty that would be assessed, and I'm wondering if either of the two, dash two or dash three sets of amendments provide for that. I didn't hear that in the description.
Senator Posansky, they do not.
Okay.
So the penalties are waived both under the VCI program and under the general amnesty. Of course, they both do have post-amnesty penalties that are higher, mm-hmm. new penalties that don't exist in current law.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions on the dash 2s or the dash 3s? And my preference is the dash 3s at this point, though we don't, we're going to recess until 9:45 on this one after we do the other bill, and then decide if we're going to work this bill today or not. Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Representative Greg McPherson from House District 38, and I'm here to describe the Dash 4 amendments, and I hope that you have copies of those in front of you. Okay, you have heard about these proposals once before when I made a presentation on a set of tax compliance proposals that I have introduced over on the House side. It was broken into two bills. House Bill 2486 and House Bill 2487, You've already picked up House Bill 2486 in the other amendments. That's the crackdown on abusive tax shelters patterned on the experience in California, coupled with a brief amnesty period. But that was designed to be part of a larger package that I had developed over the interim, which was focusing on the general theme of how, as a matter of policy changes, can we improve the collection of income taxes in Oregon. And House Bill 2487, the companion bill, had an assortment of ideas that were aimed at that general goal, which is to improve tax compliance for collection of more revenue, but mainly for improved fairness, so that people who are paying their taxes now have the confidence that other people who owe their taxes will do so as well. The Dash 4 amendments pick up the elements that were in House Bill 2487, and there are five ideas, really four specific ideas, and then a fifth provision, which is a general authorizing provision to the Department of Revenue.
So, Greg, we need your name. I failed to...
He did that.
Oh, okay. We have a debate here. They say no, you say yes.
Let's take a pause. At the risk of duplicating myself, I'm Representative Greg McPherson, and pleased to be here this morning.
That's too good.
We're going to do a roll call on that.
Looking at the Dash 4 amendments, the first of the four ideas is in Sections 8 to 10, and it is to apply income tax withholding to certain retirement distributions that are now subject to an elective withholding rule. There are certain distributions from employer-sponsored retirement plans, and they're the most common distributions. A distribution from a 401k plan, for example, when an employee terminates employment and is paid out of the plan sponsored by that employer, is subject under federal income tax law to a mandatory income tax withholding if it's not directly rolled over to an IRA, which is a tax-free transaction. Under Oregon law, however, that is an elective withholding. So that individual who does not roll over directly to an IRA can choose to tell their employer not to withhold any Oregon income tax, and then they still owe the tax, of course, but particularly if they're locating out of state and not otherwise obligated to file an Oregon income tax return, it might perhaps slip their mind. And by withholding the income tax at the source from the distribution that's made from the plan sponsor, then if they don't owe that tax for some reason or have other offsetting tax features that would avoid owing tax, they can get a refund by filing an Oregon return, but it gets the money up front, which is a good way to make sure that tax is collected.
Mr. Chair, 100%. It sounds like that provision is to make certain that we from the government will help you not forget.
Right. It regarded as a memory device, a little aid to memory. The second idea, which is in sections 11 and 12 of the bill, starting on page 4 and carrying over to top of page 6, is to provide withholding of income tax on capital gain transactions in real estate located in Oregon, and it's aimed at out-of-state owners. Many people don't realize that even if they don't live in Oregon, if they own real estate in Oregon and that real estate goes up in value and they sell it, they owe income tax to Oregon because the property was located here. A number of states have income tax withholding for those gain transactions aimed at non-residents, and this particular set of provisions was modeled on Colorado's statute, which provides that on transactions with a sale price above $100,000, so it's only larger transactions we're dealing with, that there will be a withholding of the lesser of the net proceeds from escrow or 4% of the just confirm that percentage here. It's I believe it's 4%. Needing to refresh my memory here. Apologize, Mr. Chair. I believe it's 4%.
under 2, page 4.
There it is, 4%. Thank you, Senator. and the idea, again, is that people who are not located in Oregon and otherwise filing an Oregon income tax return may not be aware of their obligation, or even if aware, once they've got the net proceeds out of the escrow, may forget to file that tax return and pay what they owe in Oregon. And this will be a little another memory aid by holding dollars out of escrow. Now, the 4% withholding is really just a rough cut at what the liability might be, because there might be a lot more gain or a lot less gain than that. This is a way of just approximating a figure. It's twice what Colorado's is, because their top income tax rate is only half ours, so it's in proportion to the approach that they take. And again, it's an amount that's held here. If the seller of the property doesn't owe the tax, they can file an Oregon tax return and get a refund by demonstrating they don't owe it, but it just gets money up front so that we can assure that attention is paid to the process. Then, starting on page 6, sections 13 through 18 apply a mechanism for collecting local income taxes. Now, recognize that this doesn't create any local taxing authority that doesn't already exist. It is purely to achieve the efficiency of having the Department of Revenue, which is already getting a tax return from everybody who has taxable income in Oregon, to have what any local income tax that happens to be created under whatever taxing authority already exists to collect it efficiently by adding a line to the Oregon Form 40. So it's just a surcharge. It's just one item that would take an instruction in the form about the existence of a local tax, and it would be then added on to Oregon taxable income, and the proceeds collected would then be turned over to the local jurisdiction. And while it's not designed to aid the local income tax that was enacted in Multnomah County, the ideas behind it were an outgrowth of that experience. That is, they tried to create a whole separate collection mechanism and had a relatively low level of compliance, I understand, as a result of that. And this is a way of achieving higher compliance, because everybody who owes Oregon income tax would be filing a Form 40 already, or for a short form, and this is just a way of adding an item to it so we can have a higher likelihood that it's going to be collected. It's designed so that it won't cost the state extra dollars, so because the administration costs that the Department of Revenue assumes in undertaking this work would be reimbursed out of the revenue stream that's being collected.
So, Representative Pearson, on that, so why would we change Form 40 just for one county and a novel idea that is, at least in name, temporary?
Senator Deckert, members of the committee, it wouldn't be changing the form for that's sent out just to people in that county. That is, there would be what I would expect would happen is that when the first jurisdiction undertakes to do this, that is, it's a matter of request. It's not mandatory. A local jurisdiction that has taxing authority can if they queue up their measure of taxable income precisely with the Oregon personal income tax, then by making a request to the Department of Revenue, the Department of Revenue then would undertake to collect it, and the Form 40 for that year would have a one-line item added to it, which is a local income tax surcharge. And there would be a corresponding instruction in the forms, or the instructions to the form, that would explain that the item or the amount on that line is to be based on, and it would describe what the local income tax surcharge is. It wouldn't happen until at least one jurisdiction requested the service. The cost of adding that instruction and line would then be charged back to the local jurisdiction. And there's a mechanism in here for all those upfront costs of creating the system to be charged to the initial user, but if subsequent jurisdictions took advantage of this opportunity, then they would be required to share in that by reimbursing the first jurisdiction.
Right.
And it's all aimed at the same broad principle, which is that if taxes are owed in Oregon, then people ought to pay them. And the experience in Multnomah County, and it would likely be true of any local jurisdiction that used this mechanism, is if they pass a tax and they have a low level of compliance, that is, I think, harms the administration of the tax system generally, because the sense that people can ignore taxes, and I suspect that there may be people in Multnomah County, for example, who didn't pay the iTax and whose attitude toward compliance with income taxes generally may have been altered by that experience. So by helping any local jurisdiction that has the authority to levy a tax, collect it, we are improving the sense of compliance and shared responsibility in the state as a whole. If there are no further questions on that item, then the fourth item, which is sections 21 and 22, are an authorizing provision which gives authority to the Department of Revenue authority to state agencies, boards, and commissions that issue occupational or professional licenses to require evidence of income tax compliance as a condition for issuance of a license or renewal of a license. And again, it's authorizing. It doesn't require them to do so. And what's contemplated here is that there would be a pilot program using one agency or one or two or three agencies to require a demonstration by applicants about income tax compliance. What I would expect it might take the form of is providing their tax identification number so that the Department of Revenue can then match that up with the filing of a tax return. The whole idea here is that people who are obtaining the privilege of engaging in an occupation or a profession in Oregon ought to pay their income taxes that are derived from that activity, because we're conferring that privilege on them, so they should share what they owe back with the state generally to support the public services, including that structure of agencies and services that they depend on in order to be able to engage in the activity. So it's to improve tax compliance, get the broader fairness by assuring that scofflaws will pay so that everybody else feels like they should be paying as well. And then the last idea, which isn't really a separate specific idea, but it's sections 23 and 24, is a broader authority to the Department of Revenue to adopt rules providing additional income tax withholding. And this is just a generally broad authorization so that wherever the department might encounter revenue that is not being collected as effectively as it could be because of the failure to withhold it in advance, they would have the authority to do that by rule. And it was at the department's request that was included in House Bill 2487 and is in these amendments. So that concludes my sort of general overview. If there are any further questions, I'd be happy to speak to them.
Questions for Representative Greg McPherson. Senator Pozanski.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if this is for Greg or for Paul. I just want to know how these different amendments would work. It seems to me that we make a decision between dash 2 or dash 3.
Correct.
And then the dash 4 would be supplemental. They're not standalone. And so if we were going to, let's say, take the, I guess this, we now know as the Baby Boomers Memory Aid Amendment, dash 4s. That would go with either the 2s or the 3s?
That's correct, Senator. The dash 4s are really, as Representative McPherson said, is House Bill 2487.
Okay.
So it is currently now a separate bill.
So just for clarity, I think we got it, but we will decide whether to adopt the 2s or 3s. We need one of those to move to do this bill.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll do the 4 separately, if you could, between now and 9:45, just visit with the committee members to get a sense of where folks are at. We'll just try to decide that around 9:45.
Okay.
And when we come back, or I would say if and when, I'll be back, but I'm not sure if others will, but we'll need a full committee, or would want one, and we'll also allow folks who want to weigh in on the dash fours. We've heard a great deal of testimony on the twos and threes, but if folks want to weigh in on the dash fours, just wave your hands frantically, and we'll get you in brief as possible. But certainly, if you have, especially if you have objections to the dash fours, we'd want to hear that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Paul, you're free to go to the League of Oregon Voters, Women Voters. Close.
No, in recess.
Well, we want to do 8:39 now.
Yeah, just recess the 480 so you can come back.
That's why we good call. Recess the hearing on Senate Bill 480 until 9:45 and open a public hearing on, someone nod at me here, 839. I'll take that as a nod. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 839. Mary Ayala.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 839 extends a sunset provision from 2006 to 2016 for a statute that currently provides a property tax exemption for multifamily rental units for households that satisfy low-income requirements, and the multifamily units also have to be located in selected core areas or an urban renewal area. Current law allows cities and counties to pass ordinances that will provide property tax exemptions to owners of multifamily units if these units are rented by households that satisfy low-income requirements or if they're in these core areas or urban renewal areas. The exemption is subject to about 10 years. My error there. Currently, the municipalities of Portland, Gresham, and Eugene have active programs for these low-income multifamily units, and they're currently claiming exemptions. Salem also has active programs, but the exemptions expired last year. The Department of Revenue's published expenditure report for 2005-07 estimates that the 05-07 revenue impact for existing projects will be about $8.4 million. However, we're not talking about when we estimate the revenue impact for the extension of the sunset date. We're actually looking beyond that $8.4 million. We're only looking at from January 06 forward. And in order to come up with a revenue impact on that forward kind of creation of new projects, so to speak, because the existing ones will run out over the next 10 years, and they're not part of the impact that we estimate for this bill. In order to arrive at the estimate that I have, for 05-07, which is about $300,000, and 07-09, which is about $2.07 million. Basically, what I did is I collected data from Multnomah County tax assessors, getting a history of the projects and the aging of those projects over the, that will phase out on current exemptions over the next year. I did the same thing in Eugene, and from that I could get what the current number of projects are, the average number of starts per year, and the average value of the exemption that's been taken. And based on those averages, I constructed a phase-in over the from starting in January 06 forward and came up with the estimates that I have here. They're based on some very simplistic assumptions using these historical averages. I basically assumed that the construction phase on an approval and construction would be a year, year and a half, which means it would at the earliest, the first exemption could be taken on new projects in 06-07, which is why the 05-07 biennium estimate is as low as it is. And then I also took the average dollar amount of the exemptions per project and grew them by 3% because I assumed that the assessed value on properties would also be growing over time by 3%. And that is all I have to say on the project, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you. Questions for Mary? Marge, we're going to go out of turn here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm and members of the committee. I'm Marge Kafori, representing the City of Portland, and with me is Barbara Sack, who is with the Planning Bureau for the City of Portland. She will explain how we've used our project in just a minute, but Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'd like to read a letter into the record from a supporter of the project.
Sure.
It's very short.
It's a short letter. Okay, yeah. Great.
This is from Unico Properties out of Seattle, Washington, and they say, Unico Properties is the owner and operator of the U.S. Bancorp Tower in downtown Portland, and we are currently reviewing a development opportunity in northwest Portland for the construction of workforce multifamily housing. The financial feasibility of the project is made possible with the continuation of the 10-year tax exemption program. It's doubtful the quality urban multifamily housing can be financially supported without extending the 10-year tax exemption statutes for qualified multifamily housing, and it's signed Gregory Van Patten, manager of multifamily investments for Unico Properties out of Seattle. And, Mr. Chairman, also, I would ask to be excused now. I have an appointment at 9:15 with a member of the House of Representatives. Thank you.
You're excused. Good to be a teacher. Ms. Sack.
Chair Deckard, members of the committee, thanks for this opportunity to appear before you today regarding Senate Bill 839. For the record, I'm Barbara Sack, city planner with Portland Planning Bureau. And I would like to thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify before your committee in favor of this bill. As you know, Senate Bill 839 extends the sunset date in the multiple unit housing statutes from 2006 to 2016. These are the statutes that enable two of the City of Portland's multifamily property tax exemption programs. This property tax exemption allowed under these statutes is for a maximum of 10 years and is on the improvement value of the property. The land is still taxed, and we'd like to point out that once land is built on, the value, according to the Multnomah County Tax Assessor, goes up, so these properties are producing some tax revenue. The reason that the City of Portland adopted the program after the legislature created it in the early 70s is that downtown Portland was losing its housing units. It lost about half of its housing units between 1950 and 1970, and it was originally the City of Portland that asked the state to authorize this program to promote new construction in Portland's core. In 1975, we adopted the new multiple unit housing program, and since that time, this program has been used to build 5,000 housing units in the central city. Most of these housing units are rental housing units and are affordable to low, moderate, and middle-income households. And then in 1975, the legislature amended the multiple unit housing statutes and allowed cities to create programs for granting a multifamily tax exemption in transit-oriented areas such as light rail stations. In 1996, the City of Portland adopted this program to help support its MAX light rail line. And since that time, this tax exemption has been granted to about 1,000 housing units in the Portland area. The area that has used this program the most is the Gateway Regional Center. This is an area where developers have used it to provide not only rental housing, but fairly affordable condominium units, some of them which are affordable to people, you know, at the upper edges of the low income and people that are a moderate income. So this has been a tool that's been used to promote affordable home ownership, and we feel like it's been very successful.
Ms. Sack, are there income limits on, if we went out to those 1,000 units, would we find folks, and I don't know what the income cutoff would be, but above, I guess, 200% of the poverty line living in those units?
We have buyer income limits on condominium units under both programs, and the maximum a household could make would be the median family income for the Portland area, which is $67,900 a year.
Excuse me, how much?
$67,900 is the 100% of median family income for the Portland area.
For a family of four, right?
Right, for a family of four. Although the household does not have to be that size. So it would go up to the condominium units go up to middle income.
So I think we'd be interested, I know I would, to know of the 1,000 units,
right.
Basically a breakdown on where, so we're not subsidizing through property tax exemptions, folks that could basically afford to live in these areas otherwise. And so I'd like to see, before we move on this bill, some sort of income breakdown of the units that we have.
Okay.
I concur with the chair. I'm very conscious of what we're trying to do, and what I'm concerned is that we're maybe potentially using money for people who could actually afford it and not getting it to people who can't, who could actually benefit from it. And I've heard, such as in the Pearl District, where some of that might have occurred.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we had testimony at the field hearing last week from a panel that was very critical of some of this program, or a program similar to this, that has been used, that's giving property tax exemptions to folks that you would otherwise think could actually afford the unit. So that'll be important for us, I think, to be clear on.
Okay. We do have affordability requirements also for rental housing projects. Under the TOD program, which is used in the light rail station areas, we require developers to provide 20% of their units to be affordable to households at 60% median family income or below, or they have to provide some alternative public benefit. We've just changed our multiple unit housing statutes in the core area, and developers now have to provide in rental housing projects at least 15% of the units need to be affordable to households at 80% median family income and below. However, I'd like to point out that this tax exemption has been used in conjunction with other subsidies to help fund projects that are low and mixed income, particularly in the central city. Nonprofit housing developers such as Reach Community Development has used this program in projects that are predominantly low income so that they could have an exemption for some market rate units and have a more mixed income project. They use this program for their Station Place project, which is an elderly housing project. Also, there have been for-profit developers who do not qualify for the city's nonprofit tax exemption program that have used this program in conjunction with other housing subsidies to provide low-income housing. And there's been a developer in Portland that has done this in several projects, the West Shore and the Pacific Tower.
Sounds like a lot of information that we'd like to see. I mean, I understand that it sounds like it's working well, but I think one of the things I'm going to be very critical is, are we actually maximizing these dollars for those individuals who most need this type of assistance so they can, in fact, reach that American dream, as compared to someone that's, hey, man, this is a windfall for us. And I understand how you may do bridging and you may do combinations of different type of programs to get there, and that's fine, but I just think it's one of those things that, personally, I'd like to see how that's being done, and is it actually accommodating the goals of our, of our mission.
Right. If I can just point out one thing, there are special historic assessments for historic properties. Some of them have been warehouses, have been converted to condominiums. Under this program, you could receive a tax exemption. But it's under a state program, and there would be no buyer income limits or price limits on the units. And this is one thing that has, there's been projects like this in the Pearl District. The city program has buyer price caps and it has buyer income limits. And in fact, the multiple unit housing program in the central city of Portland, very little of it has been used for condominium projects because the price cap, sort of precludes it. So,
well, what is the price cap, the hard price cap that you would see no one, I mean, the test would be using this property tax exemption, you would see no one residing in a unit priced at above what level?
It's 95% of FHA's maximum mortgage amount. So this year it's $203,000.
So $203,000.
Right. A unit could not be priced higher than that and be eligible for this program. In addition, the buyer would have to meet the income limit of making no more than 100% median family income for the Portland area.
So an individual who's making $65,000 on their own
could qualify for one of those if they had their funding correct, as compared to a family of four. Because what I heard was that you got at a rate of $67,000 whatever for a family of four, but you don't have the requirement that the family size be a family of four. So anyone with that income level or less could potentially qualify.
That's right. They could. But I'd just like to point out that particularly in the central city, we only have about 110 condominium units that use this program, and we have several thousand rental housing units. Mm-hmm. So what has the program has mostly been used to support rental housing in Portland Central City. So
and that $67,000, if I could, Mr. Chair, please. Is a combined family income?
Yes.
And if you have two individuals who are partners but are not legally or married, do their income get combined for that test, or are they separate and just?
It would be the household income.
Okay. Thank you.
Please proceed. We're just obviously we're interested in the program and have a lot of questions.
Okay. Well, in conclusion, the City of Portland urges you to support this bill because this program has helped us meet our housing goals, transportation goals, and growth management goals. One of the main things that this program has done has allowed us to provide an incentive for new housing around our light rail stations and also in our central city. Providing housing near light rail and in the central city helps support mass transit and reduces the need to increase road capacity and has helps reduce traffic congestion. And this was one reason that this program was instituted when the downtown plan was done in 1972. One strategy for meeting air quality standards was to provide more housing downtown, and this program was instrumental in getting more housing there. Also, this program is helping Portland meet its growth management goals. The more housing we build in our central city and in areas that were formerly industrial brownfields like the Pearl District or South Waterfront, the less pressure there is to expand the urban growth boundary. This helps protect farm and forest land. So for these reasons, we urge you to support this bill. This has been a successful program, and it's been vital to the revitalization of downtown Portland.
Thank you. So I realize my name is on this bill. I did it for Washington County because you hear the resistance, and there's going to be some resistance, too, to the date on it of 2016, mm-hmm. which is a long way out to give a property tax exemption. And just the concern that you're hearing, and I certainly feel it just reviewing this bill, is that property taxes go to important purposes, to schools, to police, to fire, to things that matter. And so anytime we're looking at an exemption, especially out to 2016, the test has got to be pretty high in terms of the good that it would bring Portland or Eugene or Washington County or any other jurisdiction that's looking at it. So I want to see a really, and we'll definitely listen to the testimony this morning, but want to see really good data on what we're getting to forego that revenue that would otherwise go to essential services in your county and others. Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other, I guess, question I would have or interest to see is these various programs that you have mentioned to us have different criteria set as to the percentage of housing that needs to be available for these lower SES. And I'm wondering if you could provide us, if not today, at some point, the criteria that's used to establish, you know, how much of that housing, 20%, 15%, or whatever that number might be, that has to meet that threshold, and how's that determined. And I know there's got to be a point of where you have a profit to actually have the investments made into it, but when you think that, at least what I've heard so far, and I'm not saying Portland's any different, but 20% is only one-fifth of the housing units, and it's less than that in many of these other programs. Just curious as to how that is established, if it's by policy or how.
I can come back to you on that.
That'd be fine.
I know when we set we just set an affordability requirement for rental housing projects in the central city, and Portland Development Commission did some analysis, and we came up with 15% of the units at 80% median family income, because we felt that a private developer could provide that number of units without seeking some additional subsidy, because these programs, the primary thrust of this program was of the multiple unit housing program, particularly in the central city, was to get new housing downtown. The city has low income tax exemption programs that are separate from this program. This program is, you can only get the tax exemption in targeted areas, and it's a way to get high density housing in areas of the city to meet public purposes. Getting housing in light rail stations and in the central city has to do with allowing people to live closer to work or living close to mass transit, so we can spend less money on transportation,
yeah,
widening roads.
I fully appreciate that. I'm just trying to figure out how that criteria is set, yeah, and I appreciate that you don't have that information today. And I know that there's formulas that are used, and you know, I guess some of the money that may come out of the federal system, that the Congress has determined through whatever means, mm-hmm, that they think so much of it has to meet a threshold for low-income housing. And I'm assuming the same thing, and just what I heard on this current one, that it was determined that we wouldn't have to see other programs being used to allow for a developer to do it. They could still accommodate that 15%. And that's fine. I just don't understand how we get to those numbers, and I'm just wondering if that's something we might want to look at to see if we can, let's say, encourage others to give more. Because one of the concerns I have is, as we have more desire, which I think we all do, to have more housing in the inner city, that we're not going to be displacing many of these people who are working the service industry in the downtown area to the outskirts because they can't afford to be there. And, you know, that we still are having that same matching type of thing.
Thank you. No further questions. I appreciate your testimony. And we have a witness list. I don't have that before me. There we go. Gerald Kubiak, Richie Wiseman.
Wyman.
Come on up.
So I go first, or you want to?
Go ahead.
Okay. We don't know each other, so. I'm Richie Wyman. I'm with the City of Eugene, and Mr. Vice Chair and members of the committee. I have this impact on people. I show up, people leave oftentimes. The City of Eugene has had this program for about 20 years. Actually, I've worked on this program for 20 years, and this is the third time I've come to the legislature asking for an extension of the program, so I'm kind of familiar with it. It's really one of the few tools available to encourage downtown housing, and that's what this program is really about. I also administer tax exemptions for low-income housing, but this is really one to encourage more housing in the core area. And I can speak for Eugene more than other communities. It's a real struggle to try to get housing in the downtown area. It's a real struggle to try to get housing that's already in the core area, even near the university, upgraded. What we have is old housing stock that's deteriorating quickly, and it's economically not feasible to get it replaced. And this is one of the few programs out there. In fact, it's about the only incentive program out there that encourages some new construction of multifamily housing. The housing that gets built really wouldn't happen without this exemption. It's a 10-year tax exemption, but it's not a windfall for the developers at all. You have to be able to prove that you wouldn't be able to build the housing but for the exemption. And so that's the first test that we look at. Could they build it without that exemption? In the past, we've looked at the projects that have been built, and they've almost all been built on bare land or very, very undeveloped land, maybe one single-family home on it. And so what you're finding is we're having no loss as a result of this tax exemption program because there wasn't any tax revenue coming in anyway. In some cases, it was on public land. In some cases, it was on parking lots or, really undeveloped land. And so, therefore, we're giving up something we wouldn't have otherwise gotten for 10 years, and then we get a windfall of money 10 years later. We think that's a pretty good deal. And it's not been a program that we have had fabulous success with. In 25 years, we've done altogether 12 exemptions in Eugene. So it's translated to 600 units, not 6,000 units. But they've been good for the most part. They've been good projects, and they have helped our core area and helped our downtown and university area both. As you know, it's a local option, and so it's not. Our school districts, our other districts have gone along with it. They recognize that there's value in it, and they have supported it. We actually put a moratorium on our program in Eugene after Measure 47 and 50 passed, and we took it off the books. We stopped allowing applications until 2003. During that time, we had virtually no projects built. So it proved that without that exemption, it didn't work because it's just... The project will go upside down without some assistance, especially during those first number of years until the rents can rise a little bit.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I didn't catch your name.
Richie Weinman. I'm with the City of Eugene.
Mr. Weinman.
Sure.
So do you consult? What form of your consultation takes place with the school districts or the police and fire? How does that consultation take place?
Well, we went to them earlier on when we adopted the provisions and asked them whether we could have whether they would go along with them, and therefore they're applied then to all taxing districts in the area.
And they
not just sitting, they
nod, or they
agreed with it. They had a motion and they approved it.
The school board did.
School board did.
Is Ms. Sachs still here? Did Portland do the same thing?
Yes.
School board passed a motion saying, mm-hmm. Do these projects, we'll forego the...
Right.
And I can only get take a nod from you if you're way back. And
okay.
If you talk...
I have to research this... We haven't had the other taxing jurisdictions
if you get 50%, then that's if you get 50% of all taxing districts to approve 50% of the total revenue, then you exempt all taxes. But they recognize the same thing, that you're foregoing almost nothing in the short term and you're getting a significant windfall in the long term. And that's what the beauty of the program is. And each and every exemption is approved by the City Council on a case-by-case basis. So at first, it has to meet the test each time. That you wouldn't be able to build the project but for the exemption, and the City Council has to approve it. So there's a pretty good check and balance there. It's more expensive to build in the core area as opposed to green fields. It's more expensive because the codes are different. If you're building higher, if you're dealing with elevators, you're dealing with much more expensive construction process because you have no place to stage the process. The workers don't have any place to park. It's just a more expensive process, and it's much cheaper and easier to build in the green fields. So you have to find some way to level the playing field if you want to try to meet our goals of getting compact urban growth, reducing transportation trips and that sort of thing. And so this is the only incentive program that's out there to help level the playing field a little bit. It's not a windfall for the developers at all. We've not seen any evidence of that. In fact, just the opposite. What we've found is that without it, they either don't build or they'll be upside down financially. I want to repeat again that the idea on this was to encourage compact urban growth, and it's not so much a low-income housing program, although actually a lot of our units have gone to lower end. They aren't all, and we see some value in seeing some upper-end units in the area. So we've only done one condo project. It actually hasn't been built yet. It was approved earlier this year, but it hasn't been built yet. But otherwise, they've all been rentals in Eugene. And I guess the only thing I'd like to add is that we think it's a great program. We really encourage you to increase it, to extend it, but we wonder why there's a sunset at all. And if there is going to be a sunset, why every 10 years? Why not 20 years? Because it's a good program. I mean, it's been extended 3 times now. Why not? Why make me come back every 10 years?
Well, you're going to come back, unfortunately, before 10 years.
I know, but I'm saying.
Because I don't foresee myself supporting a 10-year extension on this.
And this is an enabling legislation, you understand, Senator. It just enables local jurisdictions to make that decision.
Correct. But we're debating urban renewal, and we have a work group on that, and it's okay. We have real questions in tight times of where resources go and they don't go, and this is just a topic that we've decided to enter into of really scouring every area of government because we have schools and other services that that are being funded about the same level today as they were a decade ago, and so anything that affects them, we have to, I think, look at very carefully.
Certainly, and we believe that this actually adds to our long-term taxes, not decreases them.
Understand. Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wisniewski.
I'm sorry I had to step out of the room. I'd like to say thanks to Richie Wyman for being here. He is a constituent, and I assume that he'll be filling in on what I missed.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Kubiak.
Great. Good morning, Chair Deckert, members of the committee. Gerald Kubiak, Washington County Government Affairs staff. Thanks for the opportunity to speak to this. Thanks to you specifically, Chair Deckert, for your support in introducing this bill. Washington County has not in the past used the mechanism contained in this part of statute. We are supportive of it, and we've looked to other jurisdictions in the region and around the states and seen their success. We support it because we think it's something that we can use and would consider using in the future. We think it supports smart growth, livability, transportation options, particularly transit, as has been spoken to by others. And it's something that we would look to using in conjunction with the opening of the Wilson-Beaverton commuter rail line and the related Highway 217 corridor redevelopment. So it's a mechanism that we think would be useful and would help us with our goals. And it's one that we would encourage you to support and pass on to the full Senate. We'd certainly be willing to work with some of the other jurisdictions that have experience in using it in getting the committee the information you feel you need to give it further consideration. So thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Any units in Washington County at this point, none that have used this?
Senator Deckard, it's my best understanding that's the case. There are no jurisdictions in Washington County, the county included, have used it, and I can make certain on that and follow back up with you on it.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate coming down here from Hillsboro and Eugene. Our final two, Mr. Solheim and Mr. McNamara. Sorry to keep you waiting this morning.
Chairman Deckert, members of the committee, my name is Al Solheim. I am an investor developer in Portland's River District, Pearl District. I've been active in the Pearl District since 1980, and that was a time when you could count the number of residents in the Pearl District and River District on one hand. There were five people, if that. In 2005, you know, we have probably one of the most successful urban renewal vital districts in the country. You've been down there. We have an urban neighborhood that has jobs, a variety of housing types, small businesses, and schools. Critical to its success has been the housing component of rental housing, and among the rental mixture is a strong component of affordable housing. I have strong contacts with the development community. I can tell you without a doubt that for these projects, are not rental projects are not feasible without this abatement program. On Tuesday, I was visiting in Vancouver, Washington, with a principal of C.E. John Company who has the six-story rental housing project in the Pearl District. It was completed about a year ago. And just anecdotally, I said, how's your project doing? And he said, well, you know, we're almost full. We're not getting the rental rates we want, but it's a good program. It's a good project. And just totally out of the blue, he told me, you know, this project would not have worked had we not had the tax abatement. I wasn't there to talk to him about that. It was totally anecdotal. The Unico project that's being contemplated from the Seattle developer, which is for workforce housing, I know that the project will not go forward unless this tax abatement's extended. So it's easy to, you know, sort of take shots at developers, but we're talking about buildings that are made out of concrete, sometimes five, six, seven stories high, land costs, other code issues that are exceedingly expensive, and in order to make these things work, this program is critical. We're talking about yields on these projects of maybe 7.5% in order to the project to make that's a return on investment. And without them, the percentage returns even less than that. So I'm sure it can be demonstrated, and the city of Portland has tests to show that these things have to meet requirements that are set forth in the, I'm not in the provision of the program. So I guess I would argue that to see the, these urban areas continue to grow to support jobs, housing, urban density objectives, that this program is absolutely necessary to sustain those goals. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Solheim. Questions? Mr. McNamara.
Senator Deckard, members of the committee, my name is Ed McNamara. I'm also a real estate developer in Portland, though I guess I should add that for years I worked for nonprofits doing real estate development, so I'm not just a bad guy.
We're fine on developers.
Yeah. Some places that's not true. I'm here to urge you to support this extension for at least 10 years, and I'd agree with Mr. Wyman, maybe longer. And I'll tell you why. Briefly, I'll give you my reasons, then I'll give you a specific example of a project, and then I'll probably interject a few comments to respond to, I think, the good questions that the committee's raised so far. My two reasons really are that this provides really good quality housing for moderate low-income workers in the central city. It's an important need. It's an important reason. It's the best tool we have to do that. And here's one of the interjections. Without this tool in the central city, what we would get in terms, we wouldn't get much housing. We would get office buildings mostly because the returns are higher. The housing that we would get in the central city would be for the very low-income workers because there are extensive subsidy programs already for those. The low-income housing tax credit and the tax abatement programs and the housing trust fund and tax-exempt bonds and on and on, and grants that go to those. Or we would get the very high-end condominium housing where the sales prices per square foot justify the development cost. But it's that housing in the middle for the workforce housing that doesn't get built in the central city without this kind of program. And the, compared to those other subsidies, this is a very modest one. So it's filling that gap for us in Portland. I think that's what it's doing in the other cities, too. So that's the first reason it provides. It meets an important need in the cities. The second reason is that it's a really good mechanism. I think the gentleman from Eugene talked about only 600 units. Developers aren't beating down the doors to use this, and that's an indication that you've got to tweak just about right in these cities. You're not giving away the farm. The benefits really go to the residents of this housing. Not so much in that they're getting real low rents, but they're getting a decent rent in a decent place that's close to work. It's good for the residents. It's good for the employers. So the developer's really not making money on this deal. It's not a subsidy to the developer. It's an incentive to do it. What happens for us is the money that would have gone to pay the property taxes instead is applied to paying additional debt service. It allows us to borrow more money, and it closes the gap. These projects just won't support, the income won't support that much debt. So we'd have to come up with more equity. There's not enough cash flow from the project to support investing more equity. So the lower taxes allow us to borrow more money and do it with a modest amount of equity. So let me give you a specific example. Though I've been developing for a long time, I just used this program for the first time on a recent project and called the Sitka Apartments. It's in the Pearl District also. This is a 210-unit apartment building. It's going to provide affordable housing for moderate-income central city workers. It does have income restrictions for 60 years. And
what are the income restrictions on it?
The income restrictions are two-thirds of the, well, 202 of the units are, have income restrictions. They are market rate units. Of those 202 units, roughly one-third or about 72 of them are restricted to families at 50% of median household income. And Senator Brzozinski, you asked about the adjustment for family size. In rental housing, the income is adjusted for family size. So for a single person, that 50% is the maximum, about $24,000. And two-thirds of the units are for people, households at 60%. For a single person, that's about $28,500 this year. I think for a two-person household, it's about $32,000. So a single mom with a kid can earn up to maybe $16 an hour, up to that, you know, which means we're getting people anywhere from $12 to $16 an hour with a kid. So it's people, you know, earning really between $7 and $14 an hour for single people, warehouse workers, retail clerks, restaurant workers, secretaries, bank tellers, daycare workers, that kind of downtown workforce, the parking garage attendants, the people who fix your coffee. They can now live close to their jobs. That's a good deal for the employer. That's a good deal for them. It's decent housing. So Those are the income restrictions, and they'll be in place for 60 years. Those the rents are tied to 30% of that assumed income for that household size. So on our project, that tax abatement for the 10 years, it's only on the improvements. We still pay tax on the land, but it lowered our property taxes by about $100,000. That allowed us to borrow an additional $1.5 million from the bank. So it's not like we pocketed $100,000. We went out and took on additional leverage, and that closed the gap.
And what was the total cost of the project? So the property tax exemption got you $100,000 out of a total
$100,000 in expenses, which translated into $1.5 million more loan. The total development cost in this is about $30 million.
So
there's not enough cash flow because of the restricted rents and because of all the debt we're taking on to justify finding an investor to put another $1.5 million in it. So it would have either been that or more public subsidy from the other very leveraged, you know, the source. There's limited sources to support affordable housing. So we would have to come up with $1.5 million out of them or not do the project. Mm-hmm. So that's basically what you get out of it. I think you've heard a lot. So I'm just going to kind of wrap it up and say remember that this project is still... Starting right now, we're going to pay $50,000 a year on taxes for the land alone because the land in the Central City is pretty expensive. So the taxes are pretty good. You know, it's probably almost as much as you would pay on a building in some other neighborhoods. So in terms of your question about are the services there, the city's not getting a full bill, but it's getting $250 per unit per year in taxes out of this project for the first 10 years. And that's escalating at the 3%, so that's in today's dollars. In the 11th year, we'll be paying about $220,000 a year, and the building's going to be there for another 100 years. So if you look at that 100-year window, it's a pretty modest investment from the city to give up some percentage of that for the first 10 years in exchange for the social goals they're getting and the financial return they're getting. The slick thing about it is the city gets that modest investment, makes that modest investment, gets all the social goals met, and somehow gets the developer to go on the hook for another $1.5 million of debt. So it's to me it seems like a pretty good program. And as a guy who used to do it from the nonprofit side, you know, I have my questions about this, but I'm convinced that it's a neat program and it's a well-balanced one. So two other things I guess I want to add. The length of the program, I appreciate and understand your concern about looking everywhere for where we're spending our dollars. I'd urge you to give some serious thought to the 10-year extension of this. And the reason is some of our projects might be 2 or 3 years in the pre-development stage, thinking about a project, another year to get it designed and permitted and to arrange the financing. So sometimes it's 3 or 4 years from the time we start till the time we can finance it. If that program is going to sunset 3 years from now, I can't count on it. I can't design around it. I've got to assume that it's not there. So if you give a 5-year extension, you might be cutting out all the projects for the last 3 years of it, and effectively you're given a 2-year extension. So a 5-year extension isn't much. You know, in terms of the timeline that we need for a large development project in the Central City, 10 years is a pretty small extension. So if you want the program to be effective, I think you need to match that timeline with how development operates. And I guess that's all I'll add. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, thank you. And we do appreciate the testimony and the information. It's helpful to get a scope of why these projects, I mean, the acid test for at least for myself is, would they occur otherwise? And I think you've provided information that no, at least not where they are occurring. They might occur in other parts of, whether it's Portland or Eugene, outer, where the land is a little bit cheaper, but they're not going to occur. So that actually lets us hone in on the real policy choices. Is it worth it to give the property tax exemption? And just on the length of it, the reason that we put sunsets in, and I'm mindful of 10 years and the amount of time it takes to from point A to point Z of actually finishing off and cutting the ribbon on a project. But the purpose of a sunset for us is at least it allows us to review and to think about, is this today or yesterday still a good use of taxpayer money? Because exemption is just another use of taxpayer dollars. It's just an expenditure on the other side of the equation.
Yeah, no, I don't have any objection to a sunset. I think less than 10 years on this program would really really undercut the effectiveness of the program significantly. That, in my humble opinion.
Yeah. And I would agree with that. I mean, these projects are huge, and the planning and the zoning issues, code planning issues are there. It takes a long, long time to do this. It's not like just building a house.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the key to this is that at the early stage, we have to go to the bank and say, will you finance this project with this tax abatement? And, you know, they track these bills, our bankers do at least, and they say, well, it's going to expire in 2 years. Are you going to be ready in 2 years to close your financing?
So I guess the natural question on that, and I'm really mindful of the time here, is why did we allow it to 2006 for its expiration? Why weren't we in the 99 session pushing this out so for these big projects that could occur? And maybe this panel's not the one to answer that, but it's the natural question you think of when we're here at seeing the end of the program in sight and going 10 more years. It's someone maybe could visit with us about that. I'm sure that y'all probably are not the ones that were responsible in 99 or 2001 for pushing this.
We're just developers.
I guess there's maybe a strong presumption, incorrectly, that this is such a good program and such an effective program. Maybe they should have been doing it, but it make a lot of sense to extend it, and maybe people misthought.
I think you probably need to come in at least 2 years before it expires to get it extended. That's probably the minimum. So we're not, if it expires at the end of 2006, we're not too far off that.
Mm-hmm. But I'm just going to jump in there. But I've seen documentation where some of these transactions that are being contemplated right now are absolutely contingent upon the extension of this bill. So that's how critical this legislation is to a lot of these projects going forward.
Well, so I'm Mr. McNair, I can guarantee you we will think about long and hard before it will not be if this bill doesn't pass and not predicting where it goes, but it won't be because it's just kind of didn't like it at first blush. We'll think long and hard about the effectiveness, the testimony that y'all provided in the previous, and then make a call on it. It won't be a brief decision or one without a lot of thought.
Perfect. I'd be happy to come back down anytime if you have more questions.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 839, and let's recess, although we're right up against the clock. We can move back into 480. It's the will of the...
Are we just going to go to work session and vote? If we're going to do that, I think we can do it. If we're talking about...
I'll take the lead of the chair, so you tell me what you want.
I'm okay. Okay, so on 480, I'm good to go on the -3s and the -4s, but would want a unanimous vote and would leave it up to the committee. If they are ready to go on the 3s and 4s, we can move the bill.
That's good. Mr. Chair,
reopen a work session on Senate Bill 480.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move the -3 amendments to Senate Bill 480.
Senator Starr has moved the -3 amendments to Senate Bill 480. Discussion.
Just a question, Mr. Chair. So
yeah.
These are parallel. They're not conflicting, 3 and 4, right?
Correct.
Okay.
The 3s we have to have. The 4s are optional. Optional.
Okay. They're separate.
The 3 is the core of the bill.
Great.
Further discussion. Any objection to Senator Starr's motion? So ordered.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 480.
Senator Starr has moved the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 480. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 480 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 480 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Chair.
Senator Brzezinski.
The only thing I want to say is I think we've worked this very long and thoughtful. I personally would like to have seen a nominal penalty for those individuals that have not been paying their taxes and understand that not that necessarily we're going to have a constitutional problem, but that wasn't the desire, and I'm going to support the bill. But I think it is something that I'm hoping we're not sending the wrong message out for all those people, such as ourselves, who have been paying their taxes timely and orderly, as compared to someone that may have been intentionally not doing it, and now they're going to get the windfall coming back in without having those penalties. And understand, if they fall out, they're going to get socked even harder.
Mm-hmm.
But let's do it.
Well, no, that was the 16 or 17 policy choices that we had in here. That was the last one that was made. I wish Senator George was here, because it was one that he felt at least moderately strong about, is that we do invite these folks back in the system, and that carrot would be there of no penalty there, just to get them back in. And I can see both sides of the equation.
I do want to put on the record, because I think the analogy, I understand this is his concern, was those who protest are the protesters. And I take it to another scenario where you have people who protest other actions of the government, in many cases where the federal government is making decisions on a foreign policy, and you have people that actually intentionally protest to the point of where there's quote-unquote that civil disobedience, where they may be arrested for not failing to disperse. They normally will go in and take the penalty that they know that there's going to be waiting for them, because they feel that that's a statement they need to make in exercising their rights. It just seems to me that in these situations, these individuals are not being held to that same standard.
Mm-hmm.
But
no, it's a good point. It's a very good point. I think the House will revisit. They're going to look at this whole bill, and that's one that I know some of the proponents of that will let the House deliberate over. It's one that we thought through very hard. Other discussion. Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 480 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Barbara, would you like to call the roll?
Senator Nestor?
Aye.
Senator Pradamski?
Aye.
Vice Chair Starr?
Aye.
Chair Deckard?
Votes yes. So Senate Bill 480 passes. I will carry the bill, and we are adjourned. Thank you.
I kept asking this question.
Oh,
I was actually explained on this program.
No,
they're very interested in
women's voters.
It wasn't good.